about some of the things that have been happening in the news in the Houses of Commons recently with the laws that were proposed on assisted dying, something we had been praying about a lot, and the laws in the decriminalisation of abortion, things like that. And they're on now to the House of Lords, so we stood to carry on praying that those things wouldn't become laws. As we're beginning to look this morning at what it is to think about the value of life. So we were thinking about it in two particular ways this morning. We're thinking of the value of life, what it means to be made in the image of God. For that to give us our value, not our capabilities or our deteriorating capabilities later on in life, or thinking about those who are disabled or with lifelong illnesses or whatever it is. Our value is not determined by what we can do. Our value is determined by God, and he's made us in his image, and that Christ himself came in that image in order to save us. That is what gives human beings value. And so that is why life is precious. So we're thinking a little bit this morning from that kind of angle, and how that's going to affect us as Christians then, even if those things do become laws, how are we going to then live as Christians? And we made a couple of applications this morning. Well, we're not going to kill. There it is, as a command of God. And we believe he is the Lord of life and death. Our lives are in his hands. And so we're going to care. We're going to care for those who are suffering, those who are disabled, those who are terminally ill, those who are dying. We're going to care for them. When our turn comes to go through periods of suffering and even to die, we're going to endure those things too. And we mentioned this morning that another question, another angle we're going to look at it then from this evening is the question of suffering. How can we think about those topics of assisted dying and abortion and to think of it in the light of questions about suffering? For those who are advocates of abortion and assisted dying and things like that, often the angle that's approached is one of suffering. So you will hear some of the MPs and some of the people who've been campaigning for these changes of the laws to be brought in on assisted dying. And normally, the stories are all kind of the same in that they'll recount the story of someone that they loved who went through the most horrible suffering, with a heart-wrenching story of something that's occurred to them. And then they say, well, now we need to campaign for assisted dying and so on, because suffering is so horrible. What we should do is do anything we can to eliminate suffering. And it can be a very persuasive argument to think of it along those lines, because we do find these stories heart-wrenching. And for those who've experienced seeing the sufferings of someone else, it is, oh, surely there must be something better than this, than the struggles they're going through as they're suffering with terminal cancer or whatever it might be, or the troubles of dementia or Alzheimer's, and seeing someone's deterioration. It does rend our hearts, doesn't it? I mean, surely there must be a way to ease their suffering, to end their suffering. Surely that must be better. And that's the way such things are approached. And the same with abortion and things like that, sometimes the same sort of thing. Well, it will be the case of, look, here's an unborn child, but they're going to be born with some disability, with Down syndrome or something or other. And maybe the doctor said, well, their life is going to be a hard one. They're not going to be able to do all the things everyone else does. Their life is going to involve more suffering. Maybe it'll be a shorter life. Maybe so on. Maybe it's not worth bringing him into this world. And so such arguments on the basis of suffering are very, very persuasive and pervasive. And the people express them a lot. Well, how are we to try and get our heads around a little bit of that conundrum? I don't think it can be particularly... I did give it an original title, Understanding Suffering, but I think I've rather overstated my ambition. I don't know if we will get to the end and say we've understood it, but at least to get our heads around a bit of it, even if it will be something we will grapple with and struggle with. You see, there is a big line that they're talking about crossing, which isn't always exactly specified. It can seem an entirely honourable end, an idea, to alleviate suffering. But it is different to talk about then eliminating the sufferer. That is a line that is being crossed in the debate, and often it seems very blurry when they talk about the one. They say, oh, well, we should do anything to ease somebody's suffering. okay, that sounds reasonable. What's being talked about there? But to talk about eliminating suffering might be a good thing, but by eliminating the person who's suffering, that's something entirely different. And we need to be quite careful as we think about such things. So let's try and at least a little bit think about suffering this evening. And let's just think about, I've got five just basic headings to think through. One, its source. What is the source of suffering? What is it to live in these human bodies that we have with our human minds, with all their amazing abilities, but also the struggles and deteriorations that they have too? In one of the other Psalms, Psalm 8, a question is posed, what is man? What is man? And we're thinking this morning of man being made in the image of God. So it is. God says, let us make man and woman in our image. What an honourable thing. What a dignified thing that is. But what does God use to make something into his image? He uses dust. He uses the dust of the earth and then stamps upon that dust the image of God. Even in Genesis 1 and 2, before the fall, that is a very weird juxtaposition of two things, isn't it? Someone has talked about the origins of mankind being both lofty and lowly, made of dust, stamped with the image of God. What an extraordinary contrast in things that is. Even in the words we use, Adam, the word that was there in Hebrew, meant ground. We who are of the race of Adam are groundlings, for we came from the ground. Even in our language, humans. Humans is Latin from the word humus, which is soil. We are the creatures of soil. That's what the word means. Human, Adam, mankind. All of them mean that. That is what we're made of. We're made of similar stuff to the animals. But then given the image of God, so made above them. And the crown of creation that God makes Adam and Eve. And there before the fall, they live there in the Garden of Eden. They walk with God. And in Genesis chapter 2, God gives them a command in verse 16. And the Lord God commanded the man, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. For the day you eat of it, you shall surely die. Before that point, Adam and Eve were created by God, created in a world without death. Adam and Eve were there to live forever. And scientists have remarked on the amazing rejuvenating properties of the body, especially in the youngsters, in children and teenagers, the amazing ability that the body has to heal itself. The amazing way it can bounce back from all kinds of things, the rate at which the body is generating new cells and growing and replacing. There almost is still in humanity the sort of insight of a life that could have been forever. A body that could have lived forever before the fall. And yet, of course, we know the story of how Adam and Eve sinned. And just as God said, the day you eat of it, you shall surely die. And so on into Genesis chapter 3, you know the story of how Adam and Eve ate of that fruit and God came. Shame and guilt and sin entered the world. God came and spoke to them. God cursed the serpent. And he said to Eve, chapter 3 verse 16, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband and he shall rule over you. Said to Adam, verse 17, cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it will bring forth for you. And you shall eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread. Until you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken. For dust you are. And dust you shall return. So when we think about suffering, we need to think about its source. It came into the world because of sin. Because of disobedience, because of all the effects of it, the judgment that came on that, the curse that came on the world. And those things that are talked of there are much more than that, aren't they? It talked about pain for Eve in childbirth, which is one thing, of course, but I think from that you could extrapolate it, of course, to all sorts of pain. All sorts of physical pain and suffering and things like that. It seems to imply, too, a friction within relationships, a pain that would come from relationships. On to Adam, he talks about the hard work it will be to tend the ground and bring forth fruit. But of course it means more than that. Of course it means that there will be a suffering and struggle in all kinds of work, whatever that might be. And death. That we will return to that dust from which we were taken. And so death comes into the world. No longer would Adam and Eve live forever, but their body wouldn't keep on regenerating and keep on growing and replacing. It would degenerate. It would get diseases. There would be accidents. There would be death in childbirth. There would be all kinds of things that would come into the world because of it. And at the end of that chapter, verse 24, so God drove out the man, Adam and Eve, and he placed cherubim at the east of the Garden of Eden and a flaming sword which turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life. There's no way back. There's no way to the tree of life. There's a cherubim with a sword which turns every way. There's no way back there. Sin has come to all. Death has come to all because of it. And so when we think about suffering and we experience it ourselves, we see loved ones going through it, we hear stories from other people of it, it is something that makes us shudder. It is something that affects us, that pains us, even to hear of somebody else's suffering. Those are horrible things that have come into a world that was not the way God intended. Those are enemies, things we hate. We hate to hear of someone who's got a terminal diagnosis or gone through some degenerative disease and there does seem no end to it. We hate to see a loved one in pain. We hate to see the deterioration in someone who's suffering with Alzheimer's or dementia. It causes us such pain to see it in other people too, doesn't it? We recognise it as an enemy. And on into the New Testament, it talks then about that last enemy, death. It is that. It does have that hostility that it raises within us. That anger, that grief. Because that is not the way it should have been. Those things have come about because of sin. And we see its effects in those ways. So first of all, we need to be clear on it, on its source and on its reality. What it is. Secondly, though, to think too of its purpose. We find many times in the Bible that God can use evil for good. As for something horrific like suffering and death, those horrible consequences of sin, could God all the same use them for good? Well, in Psalm 90 that we read earlier, it picks up some of those same sort of themes. A psalm attributed to Moses, who saw more than his fair share, I think, of death and suffering, witnessing that amongst the Israelites as he led them through the wilderness and things like that, of what it is to live in this world. And in Psalm 90, verse 3, you turn men to destruction. Say, return, O children of men. God gives the time for them, for life to come to an end. Our life is like a sleep, like the grass, verse 5 and 6. Then we're consumed by your anger, terrified by your wrath. For our iniquities are set before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance, verse 8. So then he gives an application in verse 12. So teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. So those things that have come about, God could use for a purpose. I'm particularly thinking in the first instance of non-Christians, of unbelievers. Could God use something horrible, like suffering, something evil that God did not intend in his perfect world, that has come into the world because of sin? And yet could God use it for good? Could God use it to bring about something good? And so C.S. Lewis said, God whispers to us in our pleasures, He speaks to our conscience, but shouts at us in our pain. Suffering is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. No doubt it is a terrible instrument, but it gives the opportunity to sinners. It removes the veil. It plants the flag of truth within the fortress of the rebel soul. What else? What else could get that truth into a soul? This adamantly had no interest, no consideration from God at all. That's one of the only things that can break in is suffering. And God's megaphone shouting through it to rouse a deaf world. So times of sickness, pain, frustration, anxieties, God could use those to put that truth in our hearts, to make us think, to consider the fear of the Lord, to teach us to number our days. When we're aware of growing old, it makes us think that our days are numbered and that there will come a day when we'll face God. Seeing others die, being touched by grief of losing a loved one, going to a funeral, those things can make an impact on our heart like nothing else would have done. As it has in the book of Proverbs, it's better to go to a house of mourning to the house of rejoicing. We don't know. We wouldn't choose it, of course not. But it's better. It can do us good to go into a house of mourning for the fear of pain, for the fear of death, to be something that brings us wisdom. That's what it is then, Psalm 90, isn't it? He talks about death, he talks about God's wrath and being terrified by it, and our days will pass in your wrath, we'll finish our years like a sigh, the days of our lives are 70 years, or if by reason of strength they're 80 years, their boast is labour and sorrow, and it's cut off and we fly away. Who knows the power of your anger? As for the fear of you, so is your wrath. So teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. And Moses is exploring, isn't it, there in the psalm, that by thinking of those serious things, by being afraid of dying, afraid of meeting God, and that helps us gain a heart of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, isn't it? To be thinking of such things. And so it is a mercy of God. Verse 14 in the psalm, oh, satisfy us early with your mercy, that then we may be rejoiced and glad all our days. It's a mercy of God. Suffering, in one sense, that God can use it to wake us up. Think in the New Testament of a story like the Philippian jailer who comes, what, inches away from ending his own life, and then cries out, how must I be saved? What must I do to be saved? He sees a glimpse of his life almost ending, and what that would mean for life to end and to come and meet a holy God. And he cries out, what must I do to be saved? So God uses suffering. And so that fear of death is something God can use for good. And again, we see that in the realm of this debate about assisted suicide. People are afraid of dying. It's a big thing, and we can understand that. We can empathise with that. But what, of course, these laws are proposing then is to take control of such a thing, that fear of the unknown, of what happens and when we might die and so on, instead to seize that opportunity and to choose to die. But by removing all sense of the fear of it, we're just going to usher people to take that step bravely, so they think, to choose their own death into an eternity they've not even thought of. It has a purpose that God could use for good. Even for Christians, that we might see that, and that might be something of our experience, even in our own testimony, of coming to faith. And still, as Christians, God can use suffering for ourselves and for those we see around us to teach us. And in the New Testament, we're told again that God could use such things for good. In James, for instance, James's letter, chapter 1 and verse 2, My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials of suffering, knowing that the testing of your faith will produce patience. And let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. God can use those times of testing and those times of suffering, even so that we might be able to rejoice in them, as Paul does. In prison and things like that, as you might know, he rejoices when going through those things. We can grow closer to Jesus. Perhaps when other things are stripped away, when everything is laid bare, as it were, and we suffer and we go through pain and things like that, when we realise these things we have no control over, it makes us turn to Jesus to ask for his help, and our need is greater. So we've thought of suffering, its source, its... Thirdly, then, its mystery. There is no simple answer, is there? Grappling with some of these things, the what we see, the way it moves us, the way God could use it. But sometimes it, even that doesn't seem to quite be working, or maybe that seems too easy, too simple an answer. Think of the story of Job, who was a faithful believer of God. And he loses everything. He loses livelihood. He loses riches. He loses family. He loses his own health. He's lost children. He's lost sons and daughters. He's lost everything. And his wife no longer particularly comforts him. She says, well, you're better off just to curse God and die. And so he has the pain of a relationship breakdown, the loss of loved ones. He has the pain of physical suffering as well. Emotional pain, spiritual pain, as he wrestles with why God should have done such a thing. The so-called friends come to help, but instead just accuse and try and come up with their overly simplistic answers to explain why God should be doing such a thing. And you go on through the chapters of the book of Job. And in the end, God answers. And chapters 40 and so on onwards. And he speaks to Job in the whirlwind. But he doesn't really answer. Not in the sense. He doesn't answer exactly all of Job's questions. He does draw near to Job, but there is no answer that God gives, no easy answer for why Job and why this has happened and why that and so on. It's a mystery too. Suffering isn't something that there's an easy answer to, that we can always just put, oh, well, that's obvious. It's obvious what God's doing. It's not. It's not at all. And yet God draws near. And the same thing, of course, in the New Testament. Well, the New Testament is that, isn't it? The story of God drawing near. Of Jesus coming to become dust. We thought of ourselves, the paradox of human nature, to be dust stamped with the image of God. What an all, or even more strange thing it is, that God would then become that. Become that dust. To come in a human body like ours, to live and suffer. To have those things of a normal life, hunger and thirst and tears and tiredness, just like everyone else in his youth and so on. And then the sufferings that came along from that through his ministry years, the sufferings of relationships and emotions as people rejected him, even his own family and the like. And then his sufferings on the cross, as we sang first of all of Man of Sorrows, what a name. And we read in Matthew chapter 26 of those sufferings there in the Garden of Gethsemane. And then as he heads to the cross, his sufferings there on the cross just increased exponentially, didn't they? And so we might think to ourselves, and sometimes we talk about it, that of course Jesus can understand and sympathize with us in our weaknesses. It isn't that Jesus went through, of course, every single experience. We might say, well, but does Jesus know what it was like to have dementia? Or did Jesus know what it was like to have breast cancer? You know, we might have these specific things and we say, well, of course Jesus didn't know that. But Jesus went through such suffering that we cannot comprehend. His suffering, even just in the few hours on the cross, increased to such an exponential level that we cannot fathom. It isn't that we go through some sufferings and we think, actually, Jesus didn't know that. It's the opposite way round. Jesus went through colossally more suffering than we could possibly comprehend. Because there on the cross, he did it with no grace and no help from God. As God turned his face away. And Jesus cried, my God, why have you forsaken me? And that was the suffering of Jesus. To be forsaken. And to suffer infinitely, exponentially more than we can imagine, just to face the wrath of God with no mercy, no kindness, no help from his Father at all. That's what he went through. So much more than we could possibly think of. And that's the mystery. The mystery of suffering is something we're always going to struggle with. And there are no easy answers. But God doesn't just give them. He comes. He comes to suffer with us, which is a very mysterious thing. So when we grapple with those things and people talk about those who are terminally ill and things like that and say, what's it? Why would God allow something like that? Some of the answers, we don't know. But God does know what it's like. The Father watched his own son suffer. God knows what it's like. There's a mystery there that we can't get to the bottom of. But fourthly then, suffering, if you think of it, it's comfort. Is that God is with us in it. This idea of suffering isn't something that God is far removed from, but something that Jesus is intimately aware of. And so that is the comfort for us when we think about suffering. Is not an easy answer, but is that Jesus understands. He sympathizes with us. He is our high priest who is there at a throne of grace. And so we can come to the Lord and say, Lord, this is so hard what I'm going through, what I'm seeing someone else suffer through. We can come to the Father and say, Lord, I'm seeing this loved one of mine grow old and struggle with this disease or this condition or whatever it is. And I'm seeing them suffer and I'm struggling with that. And the Father says, yeah, I know. I know what it's like. I saw my son suffer. He understands us. Its comfort is that, in that we're not alone in it. And that is the hope even of those back in the Old Testament. As we sang earlier in Psalm 23, that the Lord's my shepherd. And even when I go through the valley of the shadow of death, you are with me. That was the comfort of Old Testament believers. And we know more of what that is. The truth of it, to be God with us. God with us through those things. Jesus himself suffered for our good, for our salvation. As we think of suffering, it is a mystery there's no easy answers to, but that's our comfort. That God understands that we can come to that throne of grace and find help in our time of need. And time again, God helps. As we said of Jesus, he suffers there, forsaken by God. And when we go through suffering, we know we're not. There is grace and mercy. Even perhaps for somebody who might see someone who's got dementia or something, and it seems so difficult to communicate with them, and it just seems their mind's all a muddle. But we believe for that muddled believer who can't express anything anymore. We wonder what's going on in their minds. They're not forsaken. God is still with them. As they walk through the valleys, God is with them. Maybe one day in glory they'll tell us about how he was. Lastly then, as we think of suffering, we think of its hope. That suffering is not the end. We thought of that psalm of passing through that valley of the shadow of death. But it's passing through. It's passing through the valley where? Last verse of that psalm, and I'll be there in the house of the Lord forever. There I'll dwell. My cup will run over. There I'll be in the house of the Lord forever. And so as we think of this painful topic of suffering, for which there is no easy answers, we know the end. That through the valley, We will come to dwell in the house of our Lord forever. That's the end of the story. And that's our hope. And so no one looks forward to having some disease that makes us deteriorate. No one looks forward to dying and getting weaker and weaker. But we as Christians know we can go through those things with hope, looking forward to the end of the journey. And so in Revelation, Jesus speaks to a church that's going to go through suffering, and maybe that would result in their deaths. And he tells them in Revelation to be faithful unto death. That's our prayer and that's our hope, isn't it? That God would help us to be faithful unto death. That he would keep us. That he would walk with us as a good shepherd right through to the end. As we thought this morning, as we meet the Lord and see him face to face, he promises at the end of Revelation that he'll wipe every tear from our eyes. So those who've journeyed with the shepherd through the valley of the shadow of death into the house of the Lord forever, he wipes every tear from their eye. Doesn't say there were no tears. Of course there are going to be tears on that journey, on those final things that we pass through. But he'll wipe them away upon our arrival. God will be there in heaven with the handkerchief to take us by the arm and wipe those tears away. Maybe those tears of suffering in our final days, maybe tears we've had our whole life from one thing or another. And it's something we've never, never been able to be truly comforted of, a heartache that never, never goes away. Well, then he'll wipe away every tear. And there'll be no more sickness, no more death. Those old order of things will pass away. And we'll be in the house of the Lord forever. In that new heaven and new earth, the home of righteousness. When suffering, that which has been so much part of every page of our lives, well, the page will finally be shut on that. And it won't be anymore. And we'll be made like the Lord Jesus Christ. And we'll see his face. And we'll see somehow, though, still in awareness of his suffering. There in glory, Jesus already is there, a man with wounds in his hands. And there in glory, we'll still see the suffering of Jesus, what he went through for us. Maybe our own sufferings will pale into insignificance over the horizon, as it were, as we're changed to be like the Lord Jesus. As we see finally what it really was to be loved by him, to be brought safely through, to be with him in glory forever. No easy answers as we think about these topics of assisted dying and abortion and suffering and pain and things like that. But hopefully as we think about these things and think about what the Bible teaches, it can help us to fix our eyes on Lord Jesus, to fix our eyes on the hope that we have of glory. And with his help, to be faithful. Be faithful in this life, faithful through suffering, faithful even unto death.